Welcome to Catalyze. I'm your host, Sarah O'Carroll. I have with me Bruce Skellen, president of Global Immunization at the Sabin Vaccine Institute in Washington, D.C. I spoke with Bruce by phone to talk about how a coronavirus vaccine might serve as a weapon against the next global outbreak. Bruce, thanks for being willing to speak with me.
No, it's nice to talk to you. Thanks.
So we know it's only been about 3 months since the coronavirus began to spread, and yet we're already seeing a host of pharmaceutical companies announce the beginning of trials for a vaccine. From what you've been able to learn about the ideas in the mix, do any of them seem promising, or are there still too many unknowns at this point to reckon with first?
I mean, I think that it's too soon to tell. This is a new virus. And I think the important part about it, not only do we not understand everything about this virus, we also don't understand immunity to this virus. For influenza, we got it pretty well understood. But these coronaviruses are not influenza viruses. And if we're going to understand how we're going to protect people, we need to understand what kind of immunity is going to be protective. Mm-hmm. We know that for some diseases like measles, that you have lifelong protection once you get measles. We don't yet even know whether or not people who have suffered a coronavirus infection, whether or not they are immune or if they're immune for how long they might be. It's our assumption that they are. Every virus works that way. When people who are protected by the people who are infected then have some protection, but we then don't know how long it lasts. So we need to look at the immunity from natural infections and what the duration of that immunity is. It may last lifetime. It may last a short time. But we'll need to understand that as part of the vaccine development process. And I think as we look at these, we know that a number of these ideas aren't going to get very far in the development process, but that's what the development process is about. And while people talk about how long it might take, Dr. Fauci's been out there saying it's going to be a year or a year and a half, part of that is to be able to test at various stages to make sure that what you are developing is what you wanted to develop. And often in the process of vaccine development, things wash out because they don't work or they don't look like they're safe. You can't manufacture them at scale. So those are all the things that are going to happen going forward. Not everything is going to work its way to the finish line, which is the way it has to go, which is why it's encouraging that there's so many ideas out there. But my guess is that, you know, there may be several different types of vaccines that come out at the end of this that will be available, and then we'll have to make sure that there's enough capacity globally to get them to the people who need them. There's a large discussion about the need for global equity. We know that's going to be a huge issue because there's going to be much more demand than there is supply.
And of course, the manufacturing process seems to be one of the most challenging aspects at play here. Can you share some of the obstacles that affect our prospects of mass producing a coronavirus vaccine such that anyone might be able to receive one day?
Among them is we don't know which of these vaccine approaches is going to work. And in developing a vaccine, and in producing a vaccine, the production technology is pretty specific to that approach. I often tell people that it's not like a bakery where one day you can make cookies and the next day you can make muffins, that if you're going to develop a vaccine, the equipment to do that is specialized to the type of vaccine that you're making. So we know that flu vaccines are made in eggs, so there's a whole system for developing vaccines in eggs. It's unlikely that the coronavirus is going to work in that system. There are a number of other ideas out there that are referred to as platform technologies, and many of them are relatively new and they're not at full scale. So the question is trying to think which vaccines might be the most promising and starting now to think through where in the United States and where globally might we be able to make these vaccines, or do we have to start developing new facilities so that when the vaccine is proven to be the right one, we can start making it. And the flattening the curve is two things. As everybody's seen, the flattening the curve is to keep people out of the way of the virus, which then keeps people from being infected and going into clogging the healthcare system. The second part of that flattening the curve is until when. And the until when part is until there's enough immunity in the population that the virus can't really travel that much and can't transmit between people because most of the people in the population are immune. And there's two ways to get there: to recover from an infection, assuming the immunity you get is protective, and to be vaccinated. And that's why there's such a race for the time of a vaccine. And that's why scale is so important, because while we're focusing on the time to the first available vaccine, we also need to think of how long it's going to get everybody vaccinated who either needs to be or wants to be. And that's where the scale of manufacturing is so important.
So you've alluded to this already, but there are a lot of equity implications that emerge from all of this. We've seen a sort of war room mentality nationally with respect to accelerating the development of a vaccine. But when it comes down to implementation, what are your thoughts in terms of how governments might mitigate inequality, or at least not exacerbate it, and thinking of coronavirus prevention and treatment in the future?
Well, you know, and that's at a couple of levels. I think every country is going to have to decide that on their own. So, for example, when we thought about pandemic preparedness, we often thought about the kinds of groups who should be considered to get the vaccine when it's first available. And obviously, that you can't really predict that ahead of time. You need to understand how the problem, in this case, the coronavirus pandemic, is unfolding, because you'll need to match that program with what the needs are. But for example, when we did this with pandemic influenza, we thought about, for the United States, thought about four groups of people that should be considered early when a vaccine is available. People who are involved in homeland and national security, as you see now with the healthcare community, those who are on the front lines, because we need to keep on the front lines to keep the healthcare system going. And similarly, those who do community support services. There are others that are involved in keeping society going. It's referred to as the critical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You know, an example are emergency services, public safety personnel, fire, the people who do communications and electricity, nuclear, gas, water, sewage. So there's an understanding of the people in the country who keep the critical infrastructure going, and we need to make sure that they're protected so they can go to work and keep that going as well. And then within the general population, are there some groups at higher risk than others? So that's a broad sweep of this, but only to say that this is a way we thought about this for pandemic influenza. We'd have to rethink about what this means for the current situation, and every country would have to be thinking about this on their own, because no country is going to have enough the first day vaccines available and need to be thinking that one through. But in parallel is the larger question about global equity. That's the discussion that we have in the United States for the supply that we have, but similarly we need to be thinking about what this means for people around the world, and how there's going to be not just capacity, but a distribution system that allows fair distribution and equity for every country, knowing that in each country, nobody's going to have enough, and each country is going to have to define who their priority populations are as well. Hmm. It's not too early to start thinking about that, because these are complicated conversations that are worth at least beginning to float now, so people can have them. So when vaccines available, they have some understanding of how they got to there.
Now, I'm sure there's a whole host of factors that biotech companies are having to take into consideration as they think about the possibility of a vaccine, such as age or respiratory illnesses. I'm sure there are many others. Can you walk us through some of those considerations?
Well, I think that the definition of a pandemic is when there is a virus that is new and that nobody has any immunity, and it transmits between people, which is why we're where we are. I think there's a recognition that this is that there's nobody on the planet who's got any immunity to this right now, and therefore everyone would benefit from a vaccine. That said, as you think about different types of vaccines, not all would be appropriate for everybody. So for example, people who have compromised immune system probably shouldn't get a vaccine that's got a live or a weakened form of the virus in it. There's also been a discussion about, you know, where pregnant women are and what kind of vaccines would be safe for pregnant women, only to say that those are considerations down the road. We first have to make sure we have a vaccine that can work and is safe for the general population. And then we can see if there are a number of different vaccines, which ones might be more appropriate for some of those vaccines more than others.
So the Sabin Vaccine Institute is aggressively involved in developing a universal influenza vaccine. How has COVID-19 affected this focus, or has it perhaps expanded or spawned other efforts at the Institute?
The Sabin Vaccine Institute focuses on on vaccines and vaccinations. So it's not surprising. This is something that's been interesting for us. As you said, we've had a project for a couple of years focusing on influenza because influenza remains, despite the fact that everybody is focused on the coronavirus, influenza remains a huge threat for the same reasons of a pandemic. And because the influenza virus mutates quite rapidly, and we think we know that it's only a matter of time until it can create a virus that has similar qualities for which there is no immunity in the population and will have a similar effect. So we haven't changed our efforts on the development of a universal influenza vaccine because we recognize that that's another vaccine that we're going to need. The reason the universal vaccine is so important and we refer to it that way is because the influenza viruses mutate so readily. That's why we have to get a new vaccine every year to tailor make the vaccine for the season to match the viruses out there. And the hope is that we can develop a vaccine that will not only handle seasonal flu, so we don't have to then adjust the vaccine for year-to-year variation, but it can also be protective against the virus no one's seen yet. The virus emerges because of some mutation or some recombination with an animal influenza virus that creates a new virus for which could have pandemic potential. So we've been pushing hard on that one, not only to think about what are the basic science that is needed to create a universal vaccine, but trying to think of transformative ideas. Are there things we should be thinking about that we haven't been? Should we look at this problem in a new way? I think we were encouraged when 2 years ago Bill Gates went out there and had this grand challenge for a universal influenza vaccine. And in it was really the theme that we've been pushing. We know how to work on our seasonal flu vaccines. We need new perspectives. We need new science. We need new scientists because we need to look at this problem from every possible angle to see if there's something else we should be doing that we haven't been.
Well, despite how fraught these times are, it's still relieving to hear from an expert to provide some context for the outbreak. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think that, you know, we're going to be watching this process very carefully. There are a whole raft of ideas for therapies out there as well. We've heard about a couple. We've heard about some AIDS drugs that might be tried. We've heard about malaria drugs that might be tried. I know that the pharmaceutical companies have lots of molecules that they've developed for all kinds of reasons, and there's a screening process going on now to see if anything that they have in their freezers might work against this. So I'm encouraged that there's so much attention there that something will come out of that relatively soon. And frankly, because there's so much disease, it makes it relatively easy, if you can say it that way, to evaluate this. Because when there's not much disease, when you have a rare problem, then you have a hard time accumulating enough evidence. Here we've got lots of people who can provide lots of evidence and the experience of what some of these products may do. But switching back to the vaccine piece, I think the other thing to keep in mind is about setting expectations. Mm-hmm. We know that in the process of developing things, there are often bumps in the road. There are things about developing this vaccine that maybe things will go shorter, maybe the things will go longer. But one thing is for sure is that not all these 100 ideas, and I don't even know half of them, not all these 100 ideas are going to make it to the finish line, and we shouldn't be discouraged when even promising candidates drop out for some reason. That's the way it goes, but that's why, you know, having more horses in the race guarantees that some of them are going to finish. Not all that leave the gate are going to finish.
This is no extraordinary epiphany, but lately I've been thinking of just how many unforeseen consequences the coronavirus pandemic has caused. The economic fallout was perhaps more predictable, but things like not being able to see a relative in a nursing home due to physical distancing guidelines, these are things that I don't think a lot of us have ever experienced before or that we really saw coming.
Yeah, I mean, that's what struck me when I got into this 15 years ago, was realizing that what starts as a health problem escalates into a full global social economic problem. And that's what you're seeing every day in some aspect of the news cycle of how this is tipping into that, and you need to pay attention to all of it. Mm-hmm. But that's why, you know, that if you don't solve the health problem, you're not going to solve the latter. So I think the challenge is how to handle both of those simultaneously, but I'm encouraged at least by what I've seen on the health side, for both promising therapies and vaccines they'll never be here as fast as people want them, but it seems that there's enough investment, enough attention, enough coordination that we'll have what we need before long.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for listening to Catalyze. I'm your host, Sarah O'Carroll, and that was Bruce Skellen of the Sabin Vaccine Institute. You can let us know what you thought of the episode or who you think should be featured next by finding us on Twitter or Instagram at MoreheadCane, or you can send us an email at communications@moreheadcane.org. Finally, to close out the show, we asked scholars to share with us their coping strategies amidst this pandemic. We got a lot of creative responses. Here's what they said.
Hi, everyone. My name's Nina, and I am recording from Guelph, Ontario in Canada. And I've been keeping busy during quarantine by practicing my handstands because I was always told that they need to last at least 8 seconds, and I'm not there yet.
Hey there, Morehead Cane quarantine crew. This is Drew McCracken, 21, checking in with some of my favorite coping techniques thus far. I've been trying to pick up knitting, hacky sack, and playing the guitar. And I also impulsively shaved my beard. So cheers.
Hi, my name is Lauren Gorento, and my fun story from quarantine is last week, my housemate Lizzie and I ordered some plain white ukuleles from Amazon, and we painted them, and now we have these cute little ukuleles to play and write songs with.
One way I've been able to stick to a routine better while living and taking classes at home is having a big whiteboard that tracks my sleep, my running, and other exercise.
Hi, my name is Lizzie, and I am calling from Charleston, South Carolina. One of the ways that I'm coping with these times of uncertainty has been to scrapbook my own yearbook.
Hey, everybody. This is Michael Alcorn, class of 2023, calling in from Waxhaw, North Carolina. I hope everyone is happy and healthy. And some ways I've been coping with COVID-19 is by picking up new hobbies like skateboarding, yoga, and video games.
A fun way I figured out to make mundane activities more fun is just to film myself doing them. Whenever I make eggs in the morning, I film it and talk while I do it, and it just makes mundanity much more bearable.
Hi, this is Grayson Sword, 23, calling in from Asheville, North Carolina. I'm getting through quarantine by trying my hand at new recipes with my family. Up next are homemade banana bread and sourdough from scratch.
My name is Luke Buxton, and I'm a junior scholar at UNC. Outside of my classwork and extracurriculars, I've been learning how to DJ to pass some time, trying to learn about transitions, matching beats per minute, filters, hot cues, loops. So I don't know, maybe if the Morehead Foundation wants to move in the direction of EDM for the fall banquet, just saying, I could be your guy.